In our prayer with Michael, we talked about God being the only true living God. And there are a number of stories in the Bible that talks about this true living God working in the affairs of men behind the scenes. But if you had to pick one book that talked about God working behind the scenes in the affairs of men, what would be that book? Book of Esther. And yet the word God doesn't appear in the book, does it? And so, if we can see the hand of God in what we call divine providence, stories of Joseph, for example, and Daniel, for example, and certainly in this one, we don't have to have a vision of God or be able to touch God. We can be convinced that He is indeed working in the affairs of men to bring about His purposes. How critical is the story of Esther to God's overall purpose? Huh?
Extremely.
How so? That's right.
Well, if the story of Esther hadn't happened, or if Mordecai hadn't found out God's plan, or if Esther hadn't talked to King Azarias, then the Jews would have been annihilated, Jerusalem would have never been rebuilt, and then it would have never been around in Jesus' time.
Okay, so the story, very story of Jesus Christ coming through the lineage of Abraham depends on what happened in the book of Esther. And in our prayer with Michael, we talked about thanking God for Jesus Christ. And when Matthew began to write the story of Jesus Christ, how did he begin his gospel? Who did he reference right in the first of his gospel?
Son of David.
Son of Abraham. And so when you go back to Abraham and David and then over to the birth of Christ, in between there is the story of Esther. And so that lineage continued by the divine providence of God, and we're studying that book. And so when we talk about one of the purposes of the book of Esther, it's a great book to talk about God's, what we call providence, how He provides for the fulfilling of His word, the assurance of His promises, even those promises that are judgmental. But there's another purpose in the book that we talked about, and that is to give the background of the establishment of a Jewish feast called the Feast of Purim. Or Purim. All right, so that's what we're looking at, the book of Esther. We went through the book and looked at a summary of each one of the chapters thus far in our study. We're still in chapter 1. And so let's go to chapter 1. Those of you who are visiting with us, we're glad to have you in our class. We're in chapter 1. And for the benefit of review and for those who weren't in the class, what's the first part of chapter 1 about?
The king's feast.
The king's feast. He had this elaborate feast, we think possibly having to do with his plans to invade Greece, as he had the nobles and military people involved in the first part of that, for 180 days displaying his glory. When all these people were assembled, what did he do? Call for Vashti, the queen, to appear. And the second part of the chapter, as we divided it, is what?
Her refusal.
Vashti says, I'm not coming. Why she didn't come, we do not know. You may hear sermons about Vashti's modesty. I don't know if it was modesty or if she was simply rebellious. We do not know. And so we've got to be careful that we don't assume things from the text. But nevertheless, she didn't come. The king became enraged. And so what's the last part of the chapter about?
Her removal from
her role or position. That's right. And that's where we're at in our study this morning. At the end of our class on Wednesday night, we were here in this last part of the chapter. And so he had, verse 13 and 14, had ask his wise men, what are we going to do about this situation? And so, verse 16, Mamukin, one of the wise men, said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also the princes and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day the ladies of Persian Media, who have heard of the queen's conduct, will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. We were noticing at the end of our class, while this quote-unquote wise man may have not responded with wise counsel, he was aware of a fact, and that is the impact of influence, and the more noteworthy a person is, and maybe the more respected a person is, the more powerful their influence. Whether Vashti ever would set out on a mission to persuade all the women of the kingdom to disrespect their husbands or not, when they knew of her conduct, this would encourage them to fail to listen to their husbands, and this man realized that. And we talked about the impact of a woman's character on others in the congregation. I said on Wednesday night that I talked about elder's wife being in the limelight, and Rod corrected me, it's not the limelight, it's the spotlight. And that's right. And so elders' wives, preachers' wives, any women who are women of influence, who have been around a while, your dress, your conduct, your speech, other women are watching you, and it will have an impact upon them whether you like it or not. But we did not get to something else that I want to address about this. It's interesting that Memucan talks about the danger of the impact of this woman's conduct on the other women in the kingdom. What about the impact of Ahasuerus' conduct on the men in the kingdom? Was his request one of love, one of consideration for his wife, and one in her interest? Was it? No, it's selfish. It gratifies pride. Look over at, just hold your finger here and go to, let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. We can talk about all the verses that have to do with woman's respect for her husband's role, which chapter 5 talks about, 1 Peter 3 talks about. And we talked about that briefly at the end of our class on Wednesday, but there's another side to that coin. And you see here in chapter 5, and in verse 25, he says, husbands, love your wives. Now, I want to ask you a question. Is that talking about the romantic feelings they have for their wives, that they want to hug them and kiss them and feel good when they look at them? Is that what this is?
No.
How do you know it's not? I agree with you that it's not. What?
The rest of the verse.
And he says, just as Christ loved the church. That's not romance. That's not affection. And how do you know he loved the church? Look at the rest of the verse. He gave himself up for her. It's a lack of selfishness. Folks, listen, when men are selfish in their rule, they don't care about their wives, they don't care about their character, they don't care about their moral conduct, they don't care about their feelings, they just care about themselves, they are selfish. And they are not ruling like Christ ruled. They may be in love, but that's not what this verse is talking about. And so as the other men looked at Ahasuerus, hey, he did this, you know, and men today, I'm the king here, this is my castle, I rule here, everything's going to go my way because I'm the boss, and God said I'm the boss, and by the way, God never commanded a man to rule his wife, God commanded the woman to submit to her husband, what he did command the man is to love his wife, but nevertheless, you notice there's no word from Memucan about Ahasuerus' influence. Isn't that interesting? Are men, are we sometimes blind? Yeah, these wise men could really see the danger about the influence on these women, but there's not one word about the influence of Ahasuerus. And fellas, your conduct, your boys are watching you, fellas who are fathers. Is this the way a father is supposed to rule a family? When I get married, is this the way I'm supposed to treat my wife? If you're an older man and respected in the congregation, whether you be an elder or a teacher or whatever it may be, other men are watching you, watching your home. What kind of example, what kind of encouragement are you giving? After all, you know, he's an elder and that's the way he treats his wife or whatever it may be, or the preacher. And preachers sometimes treat their wives shamefully. But nevertheless, you can look at both sides of this coin as we look at Esther chapter 1. Very, very practical lessons. In our prayer with Michael, we talked about learning things that will help us live for God. And while this is not a chapter on husband-wife relationship, there's some tremendous lessons to be learned from this story about Esther relative to the family. Okay, so then we come down, he said, verse 19, if it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. When the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. This word pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their own language, that every man should be the master in his own house and the one who speaks in the language of his people. It's interesting, in verse 19, they said, now, king, what we need to do here, this is our suggestion, but you need to write a law, and you need to write a law in the law of the Persians that cannot be repealed. And you remember that's true. You remember in the story of Daniel, when they persuaded the king there to write a law about Daniel, it could not be repealed, even though the king was later sorry about that law that he had signed about not praying to any other god, it could not be repealed. Now, it's interesting as you read this, you wonder, maybe these men were wise enough to know that the king may regret this later. And if he regrets removing Vashti later, where might his wrath be turned? On them. And did they know something about this king? Look over in chapter 5, for example. This is about not Vashti, but Esther. But you remember when she came into the king's presence and he accepted her. Then he said to her in verse 3, he said, what is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given you. And then down in verse 6, same thing. What is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given you. Then in chapter 7, in verse 2, in the second banquet that Esther had, inviting the king and Haman to attend, once again, he said, what is your petition? Verse 2, Queen Esther, it'll be granted you. And so, if they knew this king was that kind of king, that if he became enamored with his wife or missed Vashti, and she remembered what these guys had done, and she comes in all her beauty, what might the king do? If she is reinstated, what do you reckon she might influence him to do about these guys who had her deposed? In the book of Daniel, look over at the book of Daniel in chapter 6. In Daniel chapter 6, in verse 8, this is where those fellows persuaded this king, Darius, another in the Medo-Persian Empire, Darius the Mede. And you'll note in verse 8, they persuaded him to make this law that according to the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. In verse 12, the king replied right at the end of the verse, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. And same thing down in verse 15. So they persuaded the king to do that. What happened to these fellows?
They eventually got thrown in the lion's den.
They got thrown in the lion's den. When Daniel was rescued by God, his anger turned to those men. Now, did Daniel precede or follow the book of Esther? It preceded it, didn't it? You reckon they might have known about the story? And so they said, you write a law, they cannot be repealed, this woman can't get back into power. I don't know if that's what they were thinking, but it's just interesting anyway. that they suggested that. All right, and so then down in verse 22, that every man should be master of his own house, that's one thing. Not sure about this last phrase, and that the one who speaks in the language of his own people, possibly referring to the fact that deciding which language would be spoken in the family would be the man's decision. This would go along with the idea of him being the master of his house. They had people of different races and cultures and languages that were married, and possibly that's what it's in mind. Not certain about that. Okay, any other questions on chapter 1 or comments on chapter 1? All right, let's look at chapter 2 then. The first part of the chapter, let's look at our basic subdivision. The first part of the chapter is about what? Replacement sought for Vashti. And then what's the middle part of the chapter about? Second part. Esther selected. And then what's the last part of the chapter? Mordecai discovers this plot against the king and reveals it to Esther, and the guys are hanged. And so these are all key events as you see God's hand working behind the scenes to save his people. And so, first of all, first few verses. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. So then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king." Now, were they doing that out of his interest? Maybe. Maybe they were doing it out of their interest. We don't want this guy to get all upset over what happened now and turn his attention or his hatred to us. Let's get some other young women in here. And so, you know, as I read this, I don't know if these women were forced, but I thought of our recent history in Iraq, how the ruler of Iraq, they'd force young women to come to their service. But here's another one of these kingdoms of old, and women were like their property, and they treated them that way. So go hunt these women down, these young women, these young virgins, and for the king. So let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, and to the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. The matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Okay, so if you look down at verse 16, you'll see that when Vashti was chosen, it's the seventh year of his reign. We started in the third year of his reign, so there's a four-year gap. The seventh year of his reign would coincide with the fact that he had invaded Greece and failed. And it's thought that this guy Xerxes, who's the same as Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus and Xerxes, same person. He was a man given to sensual pleasures, of course given to pride, we've seen that. And possibly to forget the defeat that he suffered in the Grecian war, he came back to indulge himself in these pleasures. Can't be certain about that, but it's interesting that that coincides from a historical viewpoint. And so now we get down to verse 5 and Esther being chosen. Now, there was at the citadel of Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had exile. When did that exile take place under Jeconiah? What time frame? That's when the first one was. 586 or 7, right? Right in that area. And what time frame are we looking at now?
483.
Okay. It's the seventh year of his reign, so it'll be a little bit later than that, right? So he started in 486, third year before 483, and we're at the seventh year of his reign. So So we have quite a number of years, 100 years or better, since that exile took place. And so if when it talks about Mordecai, who had been taken into exile, that first word in verse 6, who, if that's Mordecai, he's 100 or better. And you have to wonder if at that age he would have been appointed to the high position that he was later in the kingdom of the Persians. And so it's possible that the who refers not to Mordecai but to Kish, which may have been his great-grandfather, but we can't be certain about that. But nevertheless, we have this record of who Mordecai is, and it says he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So she was his, he was her foster father, and it see that Esther had neither father or mother. And the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when the father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Several things I think interesting about Esther. When a young person loses their father and mother, is there the potential of this just ruining their thinking and them becoming rebellious and giving up on life? But there's no indication that happened with this woman. And here's Mordecai that takes her to raise her. But in addition to losing her mother and father, where was she living? In her homeland? In a foreign land. What kind of people would she be mingling with? Idolaters, pagan people, right? There were Jews there, but it's a pagan country. Living in a foreign land, she's lost her mother and daddy. Would you think she'd turn to the pleasures of the world and lose her faith in God? And yet, what kind of woman does it say that she is? She's a virgin. She's a virgin. And you see later in the book, she's a woman of faith. And she's a woman of courage. And she's a woman of humility. We want to make excuses for people that suffer bad things in their lives. And I've not faced the things people face. I'm not saying I've walked in their shoes. But I have enough examples in the Bible of people that have faced bad things in their lives and kept their thinking straight. Look at Joseph. Look what his brothers did to him. Look how he went 22 years without hearing from his family. Over in a pagan land. Look at Daniel as a teenager, taken into a foreign land. Educated 3 years in a pagan university. But he kept his faith. And here's this woman. And so, we as parents and grandparents, we're not doing our children any favors for excusing them for lack of responsibility and lack of being true to God wherever they're at. Maintaining their morality regardless of their society. And here's this young woman who's very interesting. And what's so interesting about this young woman, look in chapter 4, this is one of those verses that you just remember about the book of Esther. In chapter 4, the last phrase in the verse, who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this? Let's suppose Esther had given in to the lust of the flesh. Would she be in the position she's in? No, she would not. What if she had not kept her faith? What if she had rebelled against Mordecai, her uncle? Who knows what God is preparing you for and me for? We don't know. There may be some juncture in life that God can use you or use me. Be true to Him so He can use you. And so here's Esther, a young woman who is a great example of what a young woman can be regardless of the society in which she lives. A lot more we'd like to know about her. One of the indications that this book is under the influence of the Holy Spirit, because can you imagine a modern writer writing the story of Esther? How many chapters would it have? Why, just the story of Esther would be thick as this book, wouldn't it? We'd want to know about her childhood. We'd want to know what she did. We'd want to know if she ever met any men. We'd want to know a lot of things. We're not told that because that's not the purpose of this book, to satisfy human curiosity. is to develop God's plan and bringing to pass what we prayed about with Michael, the Redeemer for the world, and using the Jewish nation to accomplish His purpose. Far higher plane, far higher goal in the Bible. Okay. So, verse 8, so it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken into the king's palace into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her and her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred. Let me stop a minute. Esther's a beautiful young woman. Now she has all these maidens in attendance. She has all the cosmetics she wants, very best that you money could buy. You think, boy, that is an envious position to be in. Why wouldn't any young woman want to be honored like that? Do you remember a story in the Bible about a young woman who had that offered to her and turned it down?
Song of Solomon.
Song of Solomon. Here's a young woman. She's pretty. She don't think she's pretty, but she's pretty. There's a little shepherd boy in love with her, but all King Solomon would like to have him in her harem. There's nothing her heart's desire that she wouldn't be able to have as far as riches and wealth and clothes and maids. And she's got to make a decision. Do I marry for wealth and beauty and fame, or do I marry because of I love this young man? And because he'll have the time to spend with me, to run through the mountains together, spend time together. That's the Song of Solomon. And in the end, that's the choice she makes. And she said, love can't be purchased and it can't be quenched. That kind of love. So there's a young woman who had a choice. She chose to refuse Solomon's offer and to marry this young shepherd. I don't know that Esther had a choice. I don't know enough about these circumstances to know. Now, in verse 10, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred. Now, obviously, Esther is not a little girl. She's of marriageable age. She's now been brought into this high and exalted position of being considered for the king's harem. But isn't it interesting, in spite of that, she still respects her uncle, the man who raised her? Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Pride was not her problem. And though exalted already and later to even a greater position of authority, she was still humble and she still maintained self-control. She could control what she said, to whom she said it. And she did not make her kindred known that she was a Jew. Yes?
It appears so later that she, in any case, she shows how strong her faith is and how strong she is. And you can imagine how difficult it was for her to hold back. And I say something, you know, taking it and putting it into a situation like this where she's around foreigners and strange, you know, and still she doesn't come out and say,
especially in this group with all these other women, wouldn't you think? Wouldn't you think in the beauty parlor they'd all talk about all of this? But she didn't make it known. And there's things sometimes that are best not made known. But nevertheless, when the turn of each young lady came in to go to King Ahasuerus at the end of 12 months, under the regulations for the women, this helps explain the span of time from the 3rd to the 7th year. There's a 12-month period for the women getting ready. And then, of course, his anger subsided, and then the search was made, and then each woman had 12 months. And so anyway, you go from the 3rd to the 7th year. Under the regulation for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months for the oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and cosmetic for women. So, fellas, when you get ready to go somewhere and you wonder, why can't my wife get ready quicker? Just remember, these women took a year. the young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. And you young parents are looking for names for your children. See, here's some good names, Shashgaz and things like that. And she would not go again, go to the king unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. And when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. That's interesting, too, that she trusted this man in charge of these women, his advice as to how to prepare herself before the king. And again, you see the lack of arrogance, the sense of humility that was displayed in this woman. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month. That'd be like our December, January, which is in the month Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women. Now, when he says the king loved Esther, does this mean the love of Ephesians 5 that we read about? No. But isn't the word spelled the same way as Ephesians 5? Yes, you cannot tell by L-O-V-E which kind of love it is. You have to read the context. And this is not that he cared about Esther and he wanted to do what's good for Esther. He wanted to satisfy his passions. He was in love with her, as we would say. And she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. So he made a holiday. Your version may say a release. King James, American Standard says a release. We don't know if it's a release from taxes or a release from labor where you didn't have to work that day. But anyway, a celebration of some sort for the provinces, and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. We keep talking about divine providence as we go through this story, and things that could have changed the balance all the way through. For example, what if, we've already talked about chapter 1, what if the king didn't throw this big feast and everybody drinking and he called for Vashti? What if, when he called for Vashti, she would have came? See? And what if, now we see, what if Esther had not maintained her purity and listened to Mordecai? What if she had made known her kindred? Would this change the story? Would she have been chosen? And later on, Haman's plan, Haman's plot, would he have been able to make that plot? If, would he have even tried to make that plot if he had known the queen was a Jew? So you see these little things that are mentioned that just, all the threads, it's like weaving a, somebody compared it to weaving a fabric with multi kind of threads and colors. And you see all these things playing into, and God using people where they are, wicked people and good people, to bring about His plans. And that's the God we serve. Yes?
If that was the case, the story wasn't changed, however, but we have to look at God's providence still would have been fulfilled. God's not slack of His concern of His promise. So whether the story would have changed or altered, however, God's providence still would have.
Well, Mordecai talks about that very thing. Good point, Herb, in chapter 4, when he said, verse 14, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. So if God wants to keep His promise of bringing the lineage through the Jews, he could have found another way. That's true. But He chose this way and used these people at this time. So that's a good observation, Herb. Okay. Let's go down now to chapter 2 and let's see where we're at. Verse 19, chapter 2 and verse 19. Very, very key element. At the time, you don't know it, but very key element in the development of this story. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, why were the virgins gathered together a second time if He had already chosen Esther? You know what that question goes in, don't you?
I don't know.
Yeah, that goes in that big barrel I keep up here, but I don't know. We don't know. But nevertheless, it's interesting. Then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. Didn't she feel a sense of freedom now she's the queen? Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Interesting, isn't it? She still respects her uncle and his advice.
Is Mordecai her uncle and her cousin?
Cousin. I keep saying uncle. Thank you. I tell you what, I did that in the previous class. Wally tried to help me out, and I still didn't do any good. Cousin. I keep saying uncle's cousin. Thank you, Keith. Yeah. Somebody else's turn next class. Correct next time. Okay. You got to watch preachers. You never know what they'll say. So Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her. For Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. In those days, when Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on the gallows. And as somebody commented in a previous class, this last part of this verse is very critical. Because it says it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Not only did she let the king know, but she let the king know in Mordecai's name, and that was entered into the records for the nation. And so that becomes critical later on when the king can't sleep. And those records are brought and they're read before him. Okay. Any other comments before we go to chapter 3? All right, let's look at chapter 3 together. What's the first part of chapter 3 about? Very critical to the story.
The promotion of Haman and Mordecai not bowing to him.
Okay, Mordecai won't bow to Haman, so what happened with Haman? He is mad. He's not just a little mad. He's really mad. And, of course, you see the pride behind it. So many times we get mad because we're prideful. So, let's look at this. And, by the way, let me just say something about that. So many times when we're angry, I did a study on anger one time. A lot of times that is the reason behind it, is pride. You know, why did Cain kill Abel? You remember he got mad and he killed Abel. Why? And you just go through the Bible and you see this time and again. And why is it we get mad at somebody who got in our way on the road? What are they doing getting in my way? You know, it's all about us and we get our pride in the way. But anyway, after these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. If you were in our introductory class, we talked about this phrase, the Agagite. You may read commentaries that will say that means he was a descendant of King Agag. We do not know that to be the case. And usually you would think a descendant like that would not be called an Agagite, but an Amalekite. A descendant of Saul is not a Saulite. A descendant of Solomon, not a Solomonite. And so it makes an interesting thread, because if he is a descendant of Agag, who killed Agag?
Samuel.
Who was the king? Saul. Right. And so back in his lineage, if you see back in chapter 2, some want to make this verse 5 Kish. Is that Kish? They want to make that King Saul's father. That's possible. I don't know if that's what he's, if he's tracing this thread I'm talking about. I don't know why he would name Kish instead of Saul. But they want to say, see, there's this long standing history of Kish and Saul, and Mordecai's his descendant. And it was his ancestors who killed Agag, my ancestor, so I hate him. Well, we can't prove that. It makes interesting reading, but we cannot prove it. Yes?
Strong says that Agag was a title of Amalekite king.
It was a title. It wasn't a name. It was a title. That's right. If you're looking at how many of you have the New Inductive Study Bible like I have? Some of you have this, don't you? Look in the margin right here. There's a marginal note. You see your marginal note there? In the marginal note, it said Agagite, possibly a synonym for Amalekite. It doesn't say could be. What does it say? Is a reference to a descendant of Agag. So it's fine to get these Bibles with helps in them. Just don't depend on them. They may not be correct. We don't know that. But he didn't say it could be. He just, it is. So you want to teach a class, oh, this is good, I'll use this in class. You better check it out. Whether it's this guy, or like Sally quoted Strong's, or whether we quote Vines, or whoever it is, Vine teaches error, folks. Thayer's Lexicon teaches error. So don't just go quote sources without doing some thinking. Okay, so, again, Haman, would like to know more about Haman, but it seems really here to be focusing on his pride, because Mordecai won't bow to him. And so all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman. So the king had commanded concerning him, but Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's commandment? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him that he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. I'm mad at you, so I'll kill all your people. Isn't that great? Doesn't anger make us wise and make us people that can be respected? Look at Proverbs chapter 14. Verse 17. A quick-tempered man acts foolishly. A man of evil devices is hated. Look at verse 29. He who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. That's about anger. Now look at chapter 16, verse 18, about pride. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. You ever want to teach on that verse? Haman's prime example, isn't he? And chapter 18, verse 12 of the book of Proverbs. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, but humility goes before honor. One more verse, chapter 29 and verse 23 of the book of Proverbs. A man's pride will bring him low, but an humble spirit will obtain honor. So while we're just reading a story in Jewish history, there are very practical lessons for us, just as Michael talked about in his prayer. And another one of these I don't know things, it says that Mordecai told him, verse 4, that he was a Jew, and that's why he wouldn't bow down. Why would Mordecai not bow down? I don't know why. Somebody said, well, it's probably because Haman, they were, you know, these Persian rulers were considered as gods. But if that's the case, what about all the other Jews? Had they cratered? If that's really the case. And we know from other verses that we could read that Jews did bow down before kings. It didn't mean they deified them. Why is it? Now, if Haman was an Amalekite, forget the Agag part, if he was an Amalekite, that may partly explain it with Mordecai, because you remember the Amalekites were singled out especially for destruction because of the way they treated Israel. And so that could be. In fact, in the time of Nehemiah, we just studied the book of Nehemiah, they were not allowed to be part of the worship. And so that could be. But I don't know why. I do not know why Mordecai said, I'm not bound to the guy. I don't care what. I'll tell you one thing you have to give him. He's got courage. He's got courage. My time up. We'll pick up with verse 7.